I used to have a pager. So when I had my carpet cleaning business between 1990 to 1994, I would get paged all the time. And I'd have to pull over to the side of the road and find a cell phone, right? I mean, cell phone, pay phone. Yes. You put a quarter in. When I sold my carpet cleaning business, there was a level of freedom that I felt because, oh my God, I'm not getting paged anymore. And it was just so freeing. And I have lived with the anxiety that comes with constantly being connected. That was kindergarten compared to today. Right. I mean, you just don't escape.
That's exactly it.
I'm Dean Jackson. He's Joe Polish. And this is the I Love Marketing Podcast.
Do you have commission breath? Learn how to avoid the stench in today's episode of the I Love Marketing Podcast. In this episode, Dean Jackson and Joe Polish discuss the opportunities that are available to anyone who grabs them in Cloudlandia. They'll also dive into why you must first determine your strength, whether it be vision, capability, or reach, so you can collaborate accordingly to get bigger, better, faster results in your business. If you'd like to join world-renowned entrepreneurs at the next Genius Network annual event, then apply today for your invitation to attend. If you'd like to learn more about the Genius Network annual event or to apply, go to geniusnetwork.com.
Is Joe Polish?
That's all wrong.
Good.
That's all wrong right away. It's been so long, see? Hey, everybody, it's Dean Jackson.
And Joe Polish.
There we go.
And we had to work at that one because it's been a while. So here we are. I Love Marketing, Arizona, Scottsdale, Arizona, in Dean Jackson's hotel room because I won't let him stay at my place.
That's how I roll.
So here we are, Dean.
Saturday night.
It was my birthday not too long ago. We're recording.
We appreciate.
Yeah, we're recording a podcast on a Saturday night.
You don't keep your best girl home on a Saturday night, Joe. I thought I'd take you out and feed you, get you some nice steak. Well,
what are we going to talk about here?
So it's been a while since we were like gazing into each other's eyes doing a podcast.
I'm going to do my best not to even look at you during this whole time. All right. So look, I want to jump in. Not a bunch of babbling here. Okay. You're in town because Dan Sullivan and Strategic Coach, there's this Free Zone Frontier, which is this
great
group he has, right?
Yeah.
You spoke. You were the intro speaker.
Yeah.
And then later in the afternoon, Chris Voss, who's become a really good friend of mine, he's the former top international FBI hostage negotiator.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book called Never Split the Difference. And he's now sold over a million copies of that book. It's an amazing book on negotiation. And he gave a talk and then I interviewed him and his son, Brandon. They basically teach people how to sell, how to negotiate, that sort of stuff. And it was really awesome. And let's talk about that. We can talk about what you shared. I think that'll be for you to tell the story, kind of give you a version of some of the things you talked about. Everyone in that group pays $50,000 to be part of that group. And that was an annual thing they do where they can bring their team members. So I had six team members with me that work for me and do all kinds of cool stuff. And before we do that, though, we're having dinner tonight.
Yes.
And you said a term that you said has been around for years, but I never heard it before. And you said it's commission breath.
Right.
And so let's explain the context of this. So I have a few friends that are in the real estate business. They are real estate agents.
Yes.
And so one of them earlier today.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. I've known him for several years.
He's probably not going to hear this.
No, he probably won't. I'm going to actually send it to him so he does. So we can actually talk about it because I think it's kind of funny. No, I'm dead serious.
Okay.
I'm dead serious. It'll be something for him. And this is for all my friends that are in the real estate business. So earlier today, I told him I was going to meet up with you and have dinner at this place where we're at right now. He just shows up and I said, hey, do you want to join us? But he showed up with his partner. I don't think his wife yet. I think they're engaged.
Okay.
And I said, do you want to do you want to sit down with us? You know, we're at a 2-person table.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're my date for the night.
Right, right, right.
Oh my God. So
I had already set up a nice romantic table for us.
And yeah, he's like, well, I've got a couple of friends coming here. This place is close by. But he didn't mention anything about how, like, just an hour and a half earlier. Like, you're
saying, oh, I'm going to be there
too. I'm going to be there indeed. So I thought that was kind of funny. But then I made this comment. And of course, this, I'm not going to totally direct it because he's actually a good guy. What I said, though, I go, you know what's weird? When you're friends with someone who's a real estate agent, a lot of times the moment you start looking for a house to buy, then they change. And you said, well, they got commission breath.
Right.
And I was like, that's a great term. It's one of the things where I see people that become part of a multi-level company or direct sales, as they to call it, right? Where they start having an energy of recruitment and I can make money. Yeah. And all of a sudden, where you could be really chummy with someone, you now find them talking in a tone of voice, a tonality, commission breath, right?
Yeah, right.
So explain to me, like,
just that. You just did a great job.
No, I know, but I want you to elaborate.
Well, that's the thing. And I don't know that it's even noticeable from the other side. Like, it's not something that they're consciously doing. It's just, it happens it changes the dynamic.
Well, here's the reason I wanted to bring it up is, is in the process of, you know, I've learned a lot this last year about narcissists, and I have a whole different perspective on personal development and the self-help industry. And I'll tell you, like, not that my respect for it has gone up, it's actually gone down. The more that there's social media, the more that there's following, you know, the people that seem to have the biggest following, not all of them. I mean, I have amazing people that have giant followings. There's a lot out there that it's just such a facade. It's cosmetic. It is just like,
well, that's been interesting that, you know, Instagram's been experimenting with removing likes, removing the public display of numbers of likes.
Followers, you mean?
No, likes. And that, but there's, you know, vanity metrics like that.
By the way, they take away the status symbol, they're going to lose so much because
there's verified the check mark.
I mean, like, there are.
Oh, yeah.
Look, I've even been playing around and I'm going to actually share it at some point about getting followers, you know, paying for advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I've done a couple of things from here's the funny thing. So I I'm not going to, this will probably be in a documentary, right? Or show, because I have this whole idea about doing, you know, teaching people how to build a following. Because I'm not an expert in that area, but showing the white hat and the black hat, how do they do it with click farms? How do they do it with bots? How do they do it with advertising influencers? How do you genuinely, you know, build a bond and an engagement and stuff? And it's funny. I did this one thing, but the engagement is terrible with some of the people. But it's interesting because a lot of the followers we lost, right?
Yeah, right.
Because it's just not a right fit for, you know, a 52-year-old now guy who is a marketing guy. And a lot of people, they're not even entrepreneurs, right? That started following me. What's interesting, though, a lot of them watch the trailer that Devane Patel,
The movie.
ConnectedTheMovie.com is where the trailer is that he had made about my life. He'd funded a movie about my life, which is not out yet. And a lot of them went and watched the trailer. Like, if you go on
Instagram. They did. Okay, yeah.
And I started getting letters like, oh my God, I'm glad I started following you. I mean, like, this is really going to change my life because of the background.
Yeah.
Not my background, but just shit that happened to me. You know, as a kid and with addiction and recovery and stuff. The thing, though, that is interesting about it, the moment I did that, so many of my friends that have big followings, oh, what'd you do to get all these followers? Oh, here's what I'm doing. And then all of a sudden, these same people that are out there talking and running seminars, teaching people how I've got 5 million followers, I've got this, I got that. And it's like they bought them all.
Yeah, right.
But they didn't quite tell that to me until they saw me doing one of the things. Now, the difference is I'm going to talk about it.
Yeah.
They'll just like hide it. They'll act like they're just so fucking cool that everyone should just follow them because they're so cool. And it's like it's a game with so much of it. Mm-hmm. Not all of it, but so much of it. And it's just interesting. So the reason I'm bringing all of this up is that I'm really – everyone would be well served to read the book Don't You Know Who I Am by Dr. Ramani Durvasula. She has a great YouTube channel, millions of views. I've learned a lot about narcissism and about people that are narcissists. And it's a big portion of the people that are dispensing advice on how to be successful and how to live. And it's interesting as the world shifts and, you know, this didn't exist 10 years ago.
It really didn't.
Yeah.
When you look at that, we think about that, Yeah, that's a completely different world. The iPhone is what changed it. I mean, we were talking today at breakfast or after breakfast about the 20 years ago, the daring, you know, journalist that was going to lock himself in the New York apartment to see if he could survive for a week with just the internet as his only means of connection to the outside world, right? That was like 1997. And that seemed really daring. And I remember, because you remember those times that we're both old enough that we spent a good portion of the first years of our adult lives as no internet and no, like we learned marketing without the internet and learned direct mail where you actually had to, you know, spend money to learn how to reach people.
Oh yeah. Even spell check on a word processor, even a computer, like, you know, we were using word processors when we first started typing up sales letters and then, you know, desktop. And then these things called laptops finally became available and it was, you know, they weighed a ton, but they was so cool. And I remember even on my original ads, some of the layout, I was truly using whiteout when I was editing. Yeah. Now the people in the 70s had to use X-Acto knives and whiteout to actually even lay them out. I just remember doing that because it was easier than knowing how to utilize some of the softwares and stuff. But yeah.
But you think about that from 1997 to 2007, let's say when the iPhone first came out.
And I had one on the very first day they came out.
Yeah. And that was the end. That was the portal to Cloudlandia. The internet in our pocket at all times, right? And we all climbed through that portal and we're all living in Cloudlandia now. It's the main world.
Did you come up with the term Cloudlandia, by the way?
I've been using it. Dan Sullivan and I have been talking about it on the trail.
No, I mean, I've heard you say that a long time ago. Did you come up with that?
Yeah, I've made the distinction between Cloudlandia and the mainland.
Okay.
And 20 years ago, 1997, let's say, the mainland was the real world. And we lived on the mainland and the internet, Cloudlandia wasn't there, but the internet was a distraction slightly from the real world. But now after 2007, and it's been on this like exponential curve after it, Cloudlandia is the main world. That's the real where everything is. And we're on the mainland. We have to tear ourselves away from Cloudlandia to spend time in the mainland. And what I was saying about the journalist, you know, 1997, daring journalism to lock yourself in a hotel, only being able to use the internet.
Go more on that story.
It would be ridiculous. Now the thing is, the real daring journalism now would be, can I lock myself in a New York City apartment without the internet and survive? I mean, we talk about even little things like it almost, even when you talk about trying to look at your screen less and try and have a day without your phone kind of thing, we've become attached to it that it almost feels irresponsible to leave the house without your phone.
Yeah. It feels like you're missing your thumb or something.
Absolutely. And you feel like you're completely, like you both remember it, when you left your office or your last known whereabouts, you were off the grid. I mean, you leave your office in 1990 or 1992 or whatever, and you driving somewhere, you go somewhere, you're off the grid.
Yeah, well, I used to have a pager. So when I had my carpet cleaning business between 1990 to 1994, I would get paged all the time. Yeah. And I'd have to pull over to the side of the road and find a cell phone, right? Payphone. Yeah. Yes. You put a quarter in. And when I sold my carpet cleaning business, there was a level of freedom that I felt because, oh my God, I'm not getting paged anymore. Yeah. And it was just so freeing.
Yeah.
And I have lived with the anxiety that comes with constantly being connected ever since. And that was kindergarten compared to today.
Right.
I mean, you just don't escape.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
But everything, society is shifting to make it so that we don't have to leave Cloudlandia at all. I mean, even everything we're now, it's an app world. We run our lives. This iPhone is the remote control for our lives. And we run everything that we do through this app is designed to keep us in Cloudlandia. And it's getting more convenient. I mean, you look at even Uber, you know, there's we were at the hotel this morning, had breakfast. We're standing there. We're about to leave. I get an Uber and my Uber is there faster than you could even get to the valet counter to get your car or whatever.
Oh, I'd already given him my ticket. Exactly. Your Uber still showed up quicker than they brought my car up.
And you think about that I did that. You don't have to leave the screen. You know, I did that. I'm on here. They got in. That's the right one. I get in. I can still continue. I was on a phone call talking to somebody the whole time. We get to the place. I don't have to pay or take any time away. I just look up to see where we are, get out, and continue on. And we can continue to just live in the cloud like that, you know? And that's where then we look at, bring this back to what we talked about at Free Zone. This idea of how Cloudlandia has just changed the velocity that things happen in the real world now. We've been observing now, and everybody knows that Kylie Jenner is a billionaire. And Kylie Jenner is a billionaire on the back of her popularity in Cloudlandia, that everybody knows who she is. She's got tremendous reach, right? But she was able to turn that reach into a business by creating her Kylie Cosmetics, her lip kits, right? And I'm an observer of how things like that happen. You know, so looking behind the scenes, what actually happens? Because we've been talking a lot about this idea of who, not how, that the entrepreneurial power move is just focusing on what do you want to do? And then instead of asking, how do we do it? Focusing on who can do this, who knows how, and they're going to bring the how with them. So Kylie Jenner, what's amazing about her being a billionaire is that she has 7 people on her team. Yet there's hundreds of people that work on her behalf through the partners that she has, through her white label, through Shopify, through her mom's company that runs all of the business administration of it, which allow her and her core team of 7 people to focus on the creative elements of it, the vision. What are we going to make? What colors are we going to do? What is going to be the formulation? What are we going to name the colors? And getting it, just telling people that it's available. And then she's surrounded with these who's that make the stuff happen. So I looked at that and I've been telling that story with hopes that people see the mechanics of it, that you can do anything. You don't have to know how to do anything. You don't have to build a factory and get all the stuff to do anything. You can partner. You can white label almost anything in the world right now, right? There's nothing that you can't think that you're going to make. In doing all the research for this, I found a video of a guy that makes all the shampoo. There's only about 6 companies that make all the shampoo in the world. Just like there's only 1 company that makes all the sunglasses, right? Like when you dig into the infrastructure of all of this, all the rest of it is just the brand and the story that's built on top of the glop that we talk about, the glop that you're selling, right?
Yeah, well, hold on, back up. You said there's only one person or one place that makes sunglasses. Yeah, how's that possible?
Well, there's a company.
I mean, there's got to be more than one.
But there's not many. They have like 90% of the market. Levelor or some company, somebody listening will know what the company is. But they basically make all of the sunglasses and everybody makes their own version of them and private labels them. Yeah, it's crazy. But the reality is, the thing about it is, I tell that story to encourage people that you, with a small team, if you've got a vision, you can find the capabilities to do the things. It's all this interplay between vision and capabilities and reach. That's what it comes down to, is those three elements. And you can be a player in the free zone with any one of those three and partner with the other capabilities. So I tell that story to get people encouraged, but they get blinded by this limiting belief that, well, Kylie's famous, or she's already, they call, you know, self-made billionaire. Everybody kind of jokes about that, that, well, she was already, you know, rich, and her, she's on TV, and her, all the things that, well, that discounts the lesson for me. Well, that she didn't do anything special. But then we had the greatest gift to counter that of Lil Nas X, who in the last year hasn't even, you know, it has not been, the entire Lil Nas X story is less than 18 months old. It's not even 15 months yet, right? That Lil Nas X, in case you've been living under a rock, has created Old Town Road, the number one song in the history of the Billboard charts. There's never been a song that has been number one on the Billboard Hot 100 longer than Lil Nas X and Old Town Road. And the story of how that happened is that here's this kid, 20 years old, dropped out of college, living, shuffling between the couch at his sister's house and his grandmother's house, looking online for free beats on YouTube, comes across the beat that became Old Town Road, goes to BeatStars, downloads the, licenses the beat for $30, and makes the song in his grandmother's closet that he had converted to a sound booth, a recording booth. So he makes the song, and then on December 5th, pushes it out, puts it up on Spotify, starts sending it out all over the internet, right? It gets picked up. Someone on TikTok finds it and makes the Yeehaw Challenge. And it takes over TikTok. Everybody's doing the dance and dressing in their cowboy clothes and, you know, doing this whole thing. And it starts to climb the Billboard country charts. And Billboard says, wait a minute now, this can't be right. And they take it off the Billboard country charts. And Lil Nas X says, somebody get me Billy Ray Cyrus. He starts tweeting that out. He actually tweeted that out before they took it off the charts. But Billy Ray Cyrus gets involved in this, writes a verse, gets on the song, and it goes to number one on the Hot 100, the Global 100 list, and stays at number one for 19 weeks, longer than any song in history. The one that it unseated was, you have to go all the way back to 1992, and it was Mariah Carey and Boys to Men with that One Sweet Day song that was...
You want to sing that for us?
The number one.
Because there's listeners that including myself, that don't remember. I'm trying to place... Of course I would if I heard it, but I was trying to... I think you should sing it here.
We could do a duet later. We can end the show on it. So that whole thing, you know, happens. And then he gets two Grammys and a Super Bowl commercial. And it's just like the most amazing thing that here, if you look at it, it's again a collaboration powered by Cloudlandia that this young kid, young Keo, living outside of Amsterdam in his parents' house, in his bedroom, making beats, putting them up online, gets connected with Lil Nas X. He makes this amazing song with it. Now, all of a sudden, young Keo is this international spotlight. The story there, the point of that is that they're using the same principles, but the thing that really amplifies it is that no matter where you are in life right now, you're somewhere between Lil Nas X 15 months ago, living at your grandmother's house and, you know, making songs in the recording booth, and Kylie Jenner. You're somewhere on that polarity. And there's no excuse for you to not have the opportunity to do everything that they've done. I mean, there's so many stories of people that have come out of what's seemingly coming out of nowhere and made following this same model. There's nothing stopping you from white labeling any version of anything that you want to make. But if you start looking at it now, this idea, this is in my research, what I found, the unifying things. That's what I always love to do, is look for the context of things and see what you can take away. Because I'd look at it with the scientific method in mind, looking for what can you take that you could create a formula and apply it and get the same result, kind of thing.
Yeah. And I'm, by the way, I'm just sitting here nodding at Dean the entire time. So just go ahead.
But it's a, but it's a combination of vision and capability and reach. Those are the three things that are at play here. Three categories of asset that you could have. So if you have the asset of vision, and you don't know how to make makeup, you don't know how to set up an e-commerce site, you don't know how to incorporate a business or manage all of the accounting of everything. You know, like Kylie, you look at the who's that she partnered with to do those things. You know, this company, Seed Labs, is a giant manufacturer that will private label your makeup. If you wanted to make makeup, they'll do it for you. They make things from, you know, as low as 1500 pieces. If you want to get your creative formula and put it together, they'll make up 1500, you know, lipstick things for you, or jars of goop, or whatever you want to put together. And now you've got the capability to do that. And then reach is the thing that gets it in front of the people who can buy it. Now, the good news about being a citizen of Cloudlandia, like we all are right now, the good thing about your citizenship in Cloudlandia comes with a free radio station, a free television station, free printing press, free newspaper press, that, you know, you put a blog, you can access everything. You've got complete access directly to all the other 5 billion members, citizens of Cloudlandia. You've got instant access to everybody. And that's where the, for free. I mean, you can build that. You can build this audience yourself, just like we talked about, you know, on the back of reaching and having a loyal audience. Or you can buy reach with advertising. You can, anybody can advertise on Facebook. There's so many companies that buy Facebook ads, Instagram ads, YouTube ads, all of these things to get in front of people that, you know, you look at, there's so many billion-dollar companies that are all that way. They're called DTC companies, direct-to-consumer companies. And you look at, like, Warby Parker was maybe the first of those that did, speaking of sunglasses or glasses, that did glasses, you know? And that is an amazing thing. Every time I go to the airport now, I see these Away bags. Have you heard about the Away bag?
Oh, is that a, you know what? I don't know much.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
So it's, you know, DT's direct to consumer on Instagram. You know, they advertise everywhere.
I actually got a direct mail piece from them.
And it's a great bag. I mean, it really is. It's light. I go through those things like a lot, but this one's indestructible, basically. They thought all the right things through. Comes with a power. It's got a battery pack in it, so you can charge your phone from it. You've got all the cords and everything that you need, nice compartments. It's a beautiful, super light, super strong carry-on travel bag. Four wheels that, you know, seamless, no, nothing sticks. It's a great thing. And they only sell, you know, direct through ads. You look at Wayfair.com,
right?
You know, another company that seemingly came out of nowhere, but they started out before they became Wayfair. They built 270 individual category websites. There's so much opportunity right now. And this isn't new in a way. It's like this kind of thing. I was listening to a few interviews with Charles Koch. Do you know who he is? The Koch brothers?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
which have a love-hate relationship in the world, depending on how people lean politically.
Right, right. But from a business standpoint, he had a really eye-opening, because I'd never heard anything about him, really. You just hear all the political stuff and how powerful they are. And everybody thinks, like, who are they going to choose to be the president kind of thing, right? That's their, who they're going to put their money behind. Charles took over the company in the 60s from their dad, and it was already at $23 million. So in 1960s, they were wealthy, right, already. And he, under his watch, it grew 5,000-fold to over $100 billion now. And it's the second largest privately held company. So they're pretty up there, right?
What's the first?
I don't know, maybe Mars, I think.
Huh, okay.
Yeah. You look at the approach that he took.
Mars, not the planet. Mars.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. What he said was, and he could be part of the free zone frontier. It sounds, even the words that he used sound very strategic coach like, you know. But he says that his approach to business, here's how he did it from the 60s on, is they've approached business from a standpoint of developing capabilities that to get results for other people, and then to seek out the best partners to align with to get that result and participate in the outcome of you getting that result. And so back in the 60s, when they've got 12 different business divisions, 9 or 12 different business divisions now. But back then, the big thing was all centered around petroleum products. And so one of the big key activities that they had to do was they called it oil gathering. They had to secure the raw materials. They had to secure oil in order to refine it and do all the other things from it. And so typically what companies would do, all the companies looking to secure the oil, they would wait till a company strikes oil in an oil field, and then they would all descend on that company and compete or try to get them to sell them the oil. They would bid to build the pipeline or to buy the oil from them. And what Charles did, they thought about it from the other person's perspective and thought the advantage that they would have, the advantage that they would want if they could have it, was to be able to immediately capitalize on a new oil discovery because they could get it to market faster and start the flow going, right? So he would go to the oil companies while they're exploring, not saying after they've discovered, they say, Joe, I know you're looking for oil over here. How about if we build a pipeline now while you're looking for the oil? And if you find it, we'll be able to immediately get it to market for you. And would you then sell it to us? And of course, these companies are looking at it because they get the advantage of immediate going to market. And Charles was saying, no, we'll pay, we'll build the pipeline, we'll do it all now. And there was no competition for that because it was a big risk on their part to build the pipeline.
And they would build, what would be the percentage of ones they would build in that would never succeed?
I don't know. I don't know what that would be. But certainly he thought about it from this perspective of the oil companies are spending millions of dollars and, you know, millions of dollars in research and stuff. They're not drilling at a whim. They're drilling because they've got research and they're literally putting millions of dollars into finding oil in this spot. And if they are doing that in 10 oil fields, that it probably made economic sense that if we build 10 pipelines, just like they're saying, if we drill 10 fields, we're going to find oil in some of them. And that's what he's saying is the alignment of your goal with their goal and your capability to support a better outcome for them than they would get without you. Right?
Right.
That's the lesson in this, right? So when he did that, the vision that I had was, you know, think about it, that all these companies, you know, I call it, the vision I had was that all these companies, like waiting for them to find the oil, and then all these companies show up. It's like they come out to the shipping dock. And they've got this need, they've got some money that they're going to spend, or they've got something that all these other businesses want to compete for. Oh, let us do it. Oh, we'll do it. We'll do it. Because it's a sure thing, right? And they want to get the, they want them to pay for it. And everybody's competing. And what I realized was that what Charles was doing and what we could possibly do in any of those situations is to approach a company from the receiving dock instead of the shipping dock. We're at the shipping dock trying to get purchase orders. We want people to give us money to go and get a result for them. And rather than what he was doing, it's coming around to the receiving dock where everybody's wide open to receiving new money in their business, right? It's so, it's an amazing thought that that's unguarded, that it's, they're happy to see you. You're welcomed with open arms rather than swatted away like a pest trying to take stuff from them. You're bringing stuff into them. And it's such a profound like shift, you know, that if you've got a capability that could partner with somebody else, the outcomes that you could create, just like this, like Kylie, their situation, you know, like the company that the Seed Labs, they came to Kylie and said, hey, we can do this for you. We can do this. Why don't we partner on this? We've got this whole factory that can make everything. You don't have to do any of it. You just tell us what you want. We'll do it. I mean, it's like there's so much opportunity like that out there right now. If you think about taking inventory of what your vision, you know, are you strong on vision? Are you strong on your capabilities? Are you strong on your reach? What do you have that you can bring to the table?
So vision, capability, and reach, which so you've been talking about all the different things. I think you did a fantastic job of explaining some really good ways of frame.
I'm glad we finally, like, this is a good, I miss, like, having these conversations, honestly, like, to get things out. Because some of the best stuff that we've come up with or come out there, like, you know, more cheese, less whiskers.
I just feel like, I just feel like today I'm just the therapist and I'm letting you talk.
Yeah.
And that's I mean, which is pretty much what our relationship for over 20 years now. Like, I just need to be a jumping off point and Dean just starts talking, right? And you know what I said earlier? I was like, you know, I'm the one with all the ambition and you're the one with like just all these great, smart, intelligent things. But vision. Without me to push this and put it out into the world, it would just get stuck in your head.
It's true.
Yeah. It's so true. Who's more important, ideas or execution? Remember that one? We did a whole episode on that. We'll do an updated one at some point on ideas versus execution. Mm-hmm. You know what's funny? Because Dan and Strategic Coach, they talk about simplifiers and multipliers. Yeah. You're a simplifier.
I am.
I'm a multiplier.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have a way of looking at different ideas and looking at strategies. Yeah. I mean, that's why almost everyone in the marketing world, like, you know, you're called the marketing Buddhas. Yeah. You can bring some simplicity and you think about it. When you say I do my research, right? So you spend a lot of time putting seemingly unrelated things together in ideas. I put people in relationships that seemingly unrelated together.
I get it.
And, if you look at these speakers at my Genius Network annual event every year, like if you were to just look at the agenda, it's like, what the hell does this have to like? It seems such a random list of different people doing, bring Gabor Mate, the singer Alice Cooper, Joe DeSena, Andrew Weil, and then you have these, a copywriting panel. Yeah. How to sell your business panel. There's all these random things, but it just fits when you kind of put it together. You do that really well with looking at ideas. And there's still going to be people that are listening to this that are going to be like, all right, they stumbled on something. They got lucky. They were in the right family. And they'll still make excuses. So I want you to talk about if someone feels like they don't have vision, they don't have capability, they don't have reach. Now, we know that this is all in the head, right? Because you can just explain, you already kind of explained it. But what would you say to someone to strengthen those or to open it up or to get out of the fog? If you're in a fog, like, all right, I get it. That sounds cool. That's kind of inspiring, but I'm not doing that. I haven't done it yet. I haven't had that thing. How does someone harness the stamina, the persistence, the juice, the energy to actually capitalize on these things that are all around us? Because I think a lot of people are in paralysis because of all the options.
I get it. So here's the move. Here's like the very first move is no matter what, you've got to have some kind of capability. That's what most people would have, a capability to do something.
And you can also go find that capability.
Well, that's the truth.
Yeah, that's right? What your whole who conversation.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have a capability that you are trying to sell to the marketplace, right? Like this comes back to, and it always comes back around, that, when I talk about what would you do if you only got paid if your client gets a result, right? Somebody gets a result. That when you start looking at your capability, the biggest frustration that people have is trying to sell their stuff to people. That they don't, they don't have a sales problem is what's happening, right?
They got commission breath.
They got commission breath. But there's the thing, right? Like you look at it that if you thought through, how could I use my capability for other people, right? And instead of approaching your potential clients, if you're looking for customers kind of thing, instead of approaching it like that, what if you thought about approaching it as like partners? Who could you partner with to get the result that you're able to get? Because right now, it's an interesting thing that when you're selling something to someone, you're looking for a purchase order, you're basically saying that the people that you're trying to sell stuff to, they don't have often the businesses are in the same situation as you are, in that you're trying to sell stuff to make a profit, to stay in business, to make money, to keep going, right? And it's not that you have a lot of things you want to buy. It's not that you don't have a desire for that result or that service or that capability that this would give you. It's that often you can't afford it, right? And your clients are the same situation. It's not that they don't have a need for whatever it is that you're offering. It's that they don't have the means to pay for it right now. It's like the whole Cyrus McCormick thing of that he had the reaper that would definitely make it better for the farmers, that they, one farmer with a reaper could do the work of 14 men. But they couldn't afford the reaper to make that transition. So Cyrus gave them the reaper to use for the season and pay for it at the harvest.
Right? By the way, because we've talked about this thoroughly, but I'm always cognizant of the fact that if someone doesn't remember, if they've not listened to every episode of I Love Marketing, what kind of human would not do that with like the search for constant content out there, right? But you gotta explain that story a little more if you want to say.
Cyrus McCormick was a guy in the 1830s that invented the mechanical reaper, Right. Which was the tool. And
if we had a dollar for every person living that you think that knows that story, how much do you think we have?
Nobody. Okay. Nobody, because I'm the sick one that looks back to find these things. Right? Yeah. But the guy's name was Cyrus McCormick, and you can't it's an amazing story. Just read his Wikipedia page or whatever. But
you can get his book for a dollar on Amazon.
It's amazing, right? The story is amazing because it's credited the Reaper along with the telephone and the railroad as the three biggest advances of the 1800s that shepherded people out of the fields and into the factories. It's what paved the way for the shift from an agrarian society to industrial. And so big deal. And if he was waiting for people to get the money to buy it, it would have been a difficult thing. But he had the ability to improve the results that the farmers were getting. And he knew that they would make more money by doing it. And he was willing to let them use his tool, collaborate with them to get the result and then pay from the harvest. And he was able to charge his original. He didn't have to bring his price down to what they could afford, which is what most people do. We try and put our bring the price of what you're offering down to what people can afford, because you are insisting on getting that purchase order first rather than delivering the goods that you could deliver at full retail value when the result is delivered, you know?
Right.
And it's a mind shift. I mean, it's the most counterintuitive thing. It's the most difficult thing for people to wrap their minds around. But when you start thinking about it in terms of partnerships like that, looking for those opportunities, that's what Dan Sullivan has been naming the free zone frontier, because it's wide open. There's zero competition at the receiving dock. And we start to look for the things that when you've got the vision, when you're able to see these things, you can put these together. You look at the combination. Yeah, we should start looking at this combination here that, you know, with the vision and the connections and seeing how people go together, there's so many opportunities there.
We've talked to a lot of people over the years that go back and they listen to some of the fundamental things on I Love Marketing. For instance, if you've not read Breakthrough DNA, the report in ever, then download it. It's free. We're not selling anything. It's just a real good mindset about the before, during, and after units and the 8 profit activators, which Dean came up with. And then I had to, obviously with my ambition and stuff, make him do something with it. And then, the 9-word email, free recorded messages, magic rapport formula, lots of great interviews that we've done. I mean, there's so much great content on I Love Marketing, and we're going to create some themes that we're going to start discussing. So wherever you're at in the world, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next time another episode of I Love Marketing. Peace out.
Peace out.
Don't miss another episode of I Love Marketing. Subscribe today at ilovemarketing.com/subscribe. If you'd like to access the show notes, resources, or the exercise to help you take action on what was discussed, please visit ilovemarketing.com/367.